You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday. I'm your host Caster, filling in for Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producers Theo and Toby. If I can, coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about cost of living, the government being sued over its environmental policy, and the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry. I also spoke to Chief Executive of the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, Paul Golter, about the government's newly announced funding boost for the health sector and how far it will go to address issues. And Tuesday Wire host Alex spoke to founder of Kickback, Aaron Hendry, about the National Day of Action at the end of March and protest against the government's new move-on orders. Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Auckland Law School's Associate Professor Vernon Rives on climate litigation and the current case before the Wellington High Court.
And Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Emeritus Professor Dr. Basil Sharp about surging petrol prices and what New Zealand can learn from our response to the energy crisis of 1979.
He aha or whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai Texan on 5395, or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
As the US and Israel's war on Iran continues, Iran has continued to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed, blocking a fifth of the world's oil trade. As oil supplies shrink and demand increases, prices have jumped across the world, including in Aotearoa. With fuel prices rising amidst a cost of living crisis, questions have been raised as to what the government has done to reduce prices for New Zealanders. This week has also seen two groups, Lawyers for Climate Action and the Environmental Law Initiative, taking the government to court over what they claim is an unlawful policy for tackling climate change. As the government continues to promote tree planting as a way to offset emissions, opponents say we should instead focus on emissions reductions. Finally, this past week has also seen the report released from the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry, to strong responses from most of Parliament. While the report's findings were mostly balanced, with a mix of praise and critique for the government of the time, many politicians have seized it as fuel for their party's agenda on the COVID response. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, I asked about each of these issues, beginning with cost of living. Finance Minister Nicola Willis has warned that living costs could increase further due to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Given the government's track record on cost of living, are you confident that they'll be able to support the public through this?
What I am particularly concerned about is that while we know that the poorest get hit the hardest when inflation rises, whether it's due to a war or, for example, a pandemic, that this government seems to not have laid out what a targeted and equitable approach to dealing with the fuel crisis would look like. And we back the calls from economists like Susan St. John, who have put out sensible proposals that would help support low to middle income families during this crisis.
You've recently criticised the government for inaction on supermarkets. Willis said all options were on the table for dealing with the supermarket duopoly in March of last year. Have we seen any of these options explored?
No, we haven't. And one of the problems that we have is that during this time that Nicola Willis is just hoping that the supermarkets will just turn down their profits and lower their prices, that not much has happened. If anything, the price of vegetables and mince has gone up by crazy amounts. And there are things that the government could be doing, like taxing the excess profits of supermarkets and redistributing that to our communities, splitting the duopoly and supporting alternatives to supermarkets so that growers can take kai directly to consumers in the form of urban markets, etc. These are all things the government could lay out, and instead we're just hoping that the giant supermarkets will stop putting profit over people, which is clearly not happening.
And so if we're thinking about the Green Party's policies on this and also on broader cost of living concerns moving into the election this year, what would be the main differences between how the Green Party would tackle things compared to how the government is currently looking at addressing these issues?
Yeah, and we hope we'll have more to say shortly on what our response to the current crisis will look like, so keep an eye out. But what we've long stood for is ensuring that no one lives in poverty, which is why we campaigned on effectively an almost universal payment for families so that they can have enough to make ends meet. It looks like tackling the supermarkets duopolies, huge profits by taxing their excess profits and breaking the duopoly. But it also looks like investing in the creation of tens of thousands of jobs in manufacturing and construction so that people can actually see themselves staying in this country as opposed to seeing Australia as one of the few places that they'll be able to have a stable job and housing.
Also this past week, we've seen a legal challenge against the government's climate plan go to court. Do the Greens share the concerns of those bringing the case forward, and what are those concerns?
We absolutely back champions taking the government's climate failures to court. These concerns stem from the fact that shortly after taking the reins, the government basically U-turned a bunch of climate policies, and we're now paying the price for that. And the problem that we have is that this is not just some abstract issue around meeting emissions targets. It's about whether we have a resilient economy that is adequately set up so that we can be protected for extreme weather events. So, whether we have homes that are away from flood-prone areas, whether we have a resilient and affordable public transport system, and whether we have, for example, enough solar panels in our public buildings and in our communities so that we're not so reliant on fossil fuels that lead to high cost of living pressures when we have a fuel crisis as we're doing right now due to a war. And so we back the people taking this to the court, and we obviously back them from a policy standpoint and committed to bringing back a lot of these climate policies should we change the government.
And we've seen, the Green Party's response to, or I guess plans for climate change and the national government's plans for climate change seem radically different, not just at a policy level, but also at the way that these groups think about the issues. What's the reason for that, I guess, fundamental difference in the way of thinking about how we deal with emissions and how we react to climate change?
The way we see it is that reacting to climate change is also reacting to the cost of living crisis. And we've long supported the science around climate change, and the evidence tells us that the longer we not take action, the more expensive it'll become and the more it'll cost to people's livelihoods. We've seen this in the Auckland floods, and it should have been a wake-up call for us to do more to better protect our communities from extreme weather events, whether it is by making sure that we green out spaces around areas that are flood prone, that we intensify neighborhoods while actually moving some houses that are in flood prone areas so that we can sponge up the rain. But it also looks like investing in rail, whether it's city rail or interregional rail, so that people can have better forms of transport. All these things are not just good for climate change and tackling it, but actually also good for people's pockets. And the government seems hell-bent in making us more reliant on fossil fuels, which is clearly not working, especially now that we're being hit by a fuel crisis.
And especially given it's an election year, we've seen some criticism of the Green Party in the past, and we're probably going to see some more again this year, for its focus on social issues, which some say is coming at the expense of a focus on environment and climate policy. What would you say to these concerns?
The Green Party sees the interconnectedness of everything. We cannot address the environmental crisis without addressing poverty, and we can't address poverty if people do not have access to healthy rivers, drinkable water, and healthy kai because the soil is well. And we've long shown our commitment to environmental protection policies through the emissions reduction plan that we packaged, which is an alternative to what the government is doing, and in a green budget that shows that we can create thousands of jobs to restore nature by supercharging the Green Jobs program, and so Jobs for Nature program, sorry. And so it's absolutely possible. And I always taken the stance that environmental policies and politics without taking a class analysis to it is just gardening.
Lastly, I want to talk about the COVID-19 inquiry phase 2 report. What does the Green Party make of the results of this inquiry second stage?
Yeah, look, the report talks about how we, comparative to other countries, did have a good response when it came to public health approaches, and that we did save countless of lives. There are some lessons in the report for us to take in. So, for example, how we can be better prepared for future pandemics, how we could look like at better use of data and information. These are all things that we absolutely are behind. I'm concerned that most politicians from the government seem to have been fixated on issues around the length of the Auckland lockdown, which are, yes, lessons that we can take, but actually does not help prepare us for future public health crises. And so when we had an opportunity to contribute to the debate in the House after the report came out, we put out a call for the government to, for example, prioritise clean air policies, which will protect people against COVID-19, which is still here, but other respiratory diseases that make workers have to take sick days off, prevent kids from being well enough to go to school, and things that are just common sense. So our response lies on using the best available data and evidence around public health, and it's a good platform for us to all be pushing for things like clean air policies, which will prevent people from getting sick, for example.
Yeah, you mentioned a bit of it there. When the inquiry or when the report came out, almost every political party in Parliament at the moment made a big song and dance about it, you know, with media releases claiming that the inquiry supports their angle on the government's COVID response. The Green Party, as far as I can tell, was pretty unique in that it was one of the only parties that didn't make a big show about talking about this. Is there any reason for that? I guess, how does the Green Party fit in with what these other parties are up to?
Yeah, I got to contribute on the debate that happened in Parliament at the time when the report launched, and it was wild to me to see that politicians were fixated not on the substance of the report, which was in and of itself quite balanced and acknowledged that there's a lot of things the government could do to better prepare us for future pandemics. And that's concerning because we should be learning from history. This isn't the first pandemic that we experience in the past, you know, century for that matter. And so we should be taking the calls from the report to actually improve our public health so that when the pandemic hits us again, we're better prepared so that we do not see what happened this time, which is that inequality shot up, material hardship for children increased during the pandemic period. The government at the time, and we were critical of it, failed to address the wealth gap that was growing while companies were making huge profits. Everybody else was told to tighten their belts, and many families struggled. There are things we can improve upon, but we need to be led by good evidence and a public health approach to tackle these, not by political point scoring, which it seems is what was the focus on after the release of the report.
And the Labour Party, in advance of this year's election, has already announced the key parts of their health policy package. The Green Party and the Labour Party, they seem to have some overlap and some complementary, I guess, policies, given that a lot of people assume that the parties would join a coalition together if elected. In speculation, what would the Green Party's health policy look like going up to this election? Is there much overlap? Is there... what's it going to be?
Yeah, look... we support greater access to healthcare. Obviously, that's something we have in common with the Labour Party. But fundamentally, if you see our Green budget in our 2023 election platform, we also want to challenge some of the norms that have been put in our healthcare system for quite some time. And that includes, for example, the fact that services like dental care have been left to the private sector to run. And we do have cases in which dental care is run for profit, as well as GP services in some instances that are now being run by corporates. One of the things that we fundamentally want to challenge is this idea that people should have to pay exorbitant amounts for things like dental care in order to being able to keep their teeth well and their mouth well, which is why you'll see us campaigning for, you know, as we have done in the past, on issues like whether health services should be brought back into public ownership and whether they should be free altogether, which probably will go further than what Labour is proposing, which is three free GP visits.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March speaking to me about the cost of living, an environmental suit against the government, and the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
This week, lawyers for Climate Action New Zealand took the Climate Change Minister Simon Watts to Wellington's High Court on the government's lack of consultation in dismantling dozens of climate policies shortly after the last election. Also under scrutiny is the government's over-reliance on offsetting climate emissions through planting pine trees. Internationally, similar court cases have pressured governments like that of the Netherlands and the United Kingdom to revisit their own climate change policies. Next week, leaders in the field of climate litigation will gather in Tamaki Makaurau to discuss these developments and more, with an eye to the changes occurring internationally. To understand this arena of the climate crisis, I spoke to Associate Professor of Law, Vernon Rives, and Chair of the upcoming Climate Litigation Conference. Associate Professor Vernon Rives, kia ora. So starting out broadly, when we talk about climate law and litigation, are we talking about kind of newer laws that directly relate to climate, like, for example, the government must reduce emissions by a certain amount, or are we talking about the use of existing laws to make these goals, or is it more of a kind of mix?
Yeah, kia ora, Theo, great to be here. It is really a mix. So there has been a significant increase in people going to the courts to try and influence the direction of climate change policy all around the world, and New Zealand is no exception here. And litigants are using all sorts of strategies. Many of the strategies involve asking the courts for clarification or enforcement of newer specific climate change laws. In New Zealand, we have the Climate Change Response Act 2002 that was amended by the Zero Carbon Amendment Act in 2019. And in other countries, there are also targeted specific climate acts. The UK, for example, has a statutory framework which is similar to New Zealand's, and litigants have frequently and increasingly gone to the courts to get clarification, as I said, or enforcement when they think that various actors, including governments, are not complying with their legal obligations in relation to climate change.
And how influential are those overseas cases or developments to what's happening in New Zealand?
They're pretty influential. There's a lot of kind of cross-fertilisation that happens between courts in different jurisdictions and New Zealand with a legal system which is based on the UK legal system, often draws on developments in judicial decision-making from the UK, from other countries such as Ireland, and there's also increasingly reference to cases from European jurisdictions. There have been a number of really significant cases from the Netherlands, from Germany, and from other places. So judges all around the world are looking at what their fellow judges are doing, and there has been quite heavy reliance, I think, on UK case law in New Zealand climate litigation, including the case which is currently before the High Court in Wellington.
Yeah, so jumping on to that, this case has come to the High Court in Wellington this week, and it involves the Lawyers for Climate Action taking the Climate Change Minister, Simon Watts, to court for dismantling a large portion of New Zealand's climate policies without consultation, amongst some other things. How well does this case kind of fit into developments in New Zealand and in the international context?
Yeah, so it's another example of litigants asking the courts to enforce legal obligations under a piece of legislation. So it's not a, you know, it's not a radically unusual case from that respect, but there are some features of the case in New Zealand which mark it out as a little different to what's happening overseas. One of those features is the aspect of the claim where Lawyers for Climate Action and the Environmental Law Initiative are asking the court to assess whether the New Zealand government's heavy reliance on tree planting fits with its domestic legal obligations as well as its international legal obligations, and that's an aspect of the case which is different to what has happened overseas.
Right, and is that digging into kind of the difference between offsetting emissions versus reducing them?
Yeah, absolutely. The environmental groups say that it's far preferable for emissions reductions to be achieved by stopping emissions at source. So, for example, moving from reliance on fossil fuels to electricity, especially helpful in New Zealand because we have such a high level of renewable electricity generation. So they say better to get people off petrol and diesel cars into electrics, better for large industries to be reducing their reliance on coal and on oil, and for them also to be looking at renewable forms of energy. Those are all better ways of addressing this climate crisis than heavy reliance on, in New Zealand, monocultural pine plantations, which are part of the solution. Yep, they do remove carbon dioxide from the environment, but there are risks associated with this really heavy reliance on tree planting, including the possibility, increased risk because of climate change, of trees burning down or other things going wrong. The other problem with reliance on tree planting is that you really need to kind of commit to that tree planting for the long term. So if you're going to get the benefit of emissions reductions from tree planting, a forest needs to stay in forestry planting, you know, for the foreseeable future. And many people kind of regard New Zealand as significantly covered by monocultural pine plantation as not good from an environmental perspective. It doesn't help with biodiversity, and it carries those risks that I talked about.
Right, and I imagine that eventually you run out of land to plant these trees on.
Yeah, I mean, land is a limited resource. You run out of land. I guess the other problem with it is that it allows people to kind of delay the major revolution economically and environmentally, which is turning away from reliance on fossil fuels. That is going to happen. It's going to have to happen. And the longer we rely on tree planting, the longer we delay our transition away from fossil fuels towards renewables, the worse will be the pain. And that pain will be suffered by future generations who will have their options limited for them and will be having to kind of deal with more disruptive transitions than would occur if it were a smooth kind of transition over a longer period of time. So part of the claim is let's not leave this problem for future generations. Let's start dealing with it now.
So if the government is found to have acted unlawfully, is there anything stopping them from passing legislation that makes what they did legal? I mean, looking at kind of recent cases, they've indicated with the case against Uber employees being found to be employees by the courts, they've signaled legislation will be passed to change that. They've recently passed legislation in the Social Security Amendment that's gone back on what courts have found. We also had the case of police photos being made legal, taking photos of people in public. Is there anything that can stop them from then going back and passing legislation that makes all these changes legal?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to that is no. We have a constitutional system in New Zealand which gives great power to Parliament. We don't have any overriding constitution which would limit the ability of Parliament to be passing legislation. So the strict legal answer is no, the Parliament can do what it wants to. There is a preference, and that's a preference which has been kind of shared and expressed by the current coalition government, through the Regulatory Standards Bill, that type of retrospective legislation where courts are going back and effectively legalising acts which may have been declared illegal by the courts is not a good way of operating government. It's not a good way of operating in society. So there would be a political risk, I guess, associated with that kind of retrospective legislation, but technically it's possible. As you note, the examples that you gave show that governments, and not only the current coalition government, but previous governments have done that from time to time.
So looking towards placing us in that international context, are there any cases of, for example, countries taking cases against another country, or any opportunity for that to add that kind of international pressure?
Yeah, there's a lot of thinking about this now, especially in the wake of the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion, which was delivered last year, which has really kind of opened the way, I guess, for this kind of country-to-country litigation. It's very difficult to bring these sorts of cases where one country effectively sues another country. There are a lot of complexities in the international law process for that, which we probably don't have time to talk about now. But in theory, yes, it is possible for there to be lawsuits brought by countries, for example, countries who are especially exposed to the effects of climate change, attempting to sue a large emitter. And it's one of the issues, among others, that we're going to be talking about at a climate litigation conference that the New Zealand Centre for Environmental Law, Lawyers for Climate Action and the Legal Research Foundation are hosting at the Whale Pacifica, starting on the 27th of March, so just a week or so away from that. So we've got some experts who will come and talk about the possibility of that type of country-to-country lawsuits. I think it's more likely in the shorter to medium term that most of the litigation action is going to be in domestic courts, the kind of case that's happening in Wellington at the moment. And overseas, that is also happening, where environmental groups are suing their governments. Sometimes they're also suing large corporate emitters, and they, amongst their case strategy, are relying on findings of the International Court of Justice, such as the ones in its advisory opinion. So it's a kind of an interesting, complex relationship between international law, including the types of decisions that come out of tribunals and courts at the international level, feeding into and influencing domestic litigation.
That was Associate Professor at the Auckland Law School, Vernon Rive, on the climate litigation developments in Aotearoa, New Zealand and abroad.
We'll be right back after this short break. Text in your thoughts 5395. Keep it on the B.
Carhartt Work in Progress has just unleashed Audio Archives, a collaboration with 17 independent radio stations from around the world, including your faves, 95 BFM.
Audio Archives is a celebration of independent radio and includes a printed publication, a capsule collection, and a global program of radio broadcasts and events.
Check out all the details at carhartt-wip.com and search for Audio Archives. More info to be announced.
Go Cooler Music is giving away a guitar. Want to win it? Just text Go Cooler to 5395, spelled G-O-K-U-L-A, along with your B-card number and your favourite guitar player or riff, and you'll be in the draw to win a Cat's Eye Tokai acoustic guitar. Tune in to Dirtbag Radio Monday, March 30th from 7 to 9pm to hear Rapley draw the winner. Cheers, Go Cooler Music, 378 Broadway, Newmarket.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Durbidge, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
On Wednesday night, you've climbed the mountain of the week and reached the top, but before you roll down the hill, you get a reward. No, it's not the view. This is radio. No, you don't get to meet an all-powerful being. This is an alternative radio station. At the top of the mountain, you get the top 10 songs of the week on 95BFM. Brought to you by the Mountain Guardians, Sam and Jack.
The 95BFM Top 10. The toppest top tracks of the week. 7 to 8pm every Wednesday. Vote online at 95bfm.com/vote.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9pm. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio. For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio Thursday nights from 7 till 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki. Arcade Radio.
Only on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
With the Strait of Hormuz currently under an Iranian blockade, 20% of the world's daily oil traffic now sits immobilized behind a wall of sea mines. 2.5 weeks into the war, people across the globe are feeling the effects of the conflict in the form of spiking fuel prices. With petrol prices in New Zealand surging past $3 per litre, the government is considering its options. I spoke to Emeritus Professor and Energy Economics Expert Dr. Basil Sharp about the lessons we've learned or perhaps failed to learn from our response to the oil crisis of 1979 and what we could do now to improve our energy security in New Zealand. So this isn't the first time that political turmoil in Iran has led to a spike in petrol prices in New Zealand. Back in 1979, in response to the oil crisis triggered by the Islamic Revolution, the national government under Muldoon famously introduced carless days. What, if anything, did we learn from this experiment in reducing demand for petrol?
Well, we learned that the policy was a failure, basically. I remember it well because I was around at that time, and I remember the stickers that we had to put on our windscreens that prescribed the days that we could use our car or couldn't use our car, whatever the case may be. And basically, it was very, very unpopular. It was a nuisance for commuters, travellers. We didn't really have a big urban centres, didn't have well-developed urban transport systems. So it was very unpopular. And after, I can't remember exactly when, but it was probably a year or so, the government ditched it. It was touted as a failure at the time.
For those of us who are too young to remember this, could you just remind us how it worked? Am I right in thinking that individual car owners got to choose what day they weren't allowed to drive on?
That's my recollection. One would have to apply for the sticker, and you would place the sticker on your windscreen. And of course, if you were caught, and you know, policing this costs money, so you had to allocate resources to police it. But if you were caught, you were fined. But then, you know, people are quite innovative and they find ways around these things. Bogus stickers, driving at times of night when the compliance folk are not out there policing it and so on.
Recently, the government has suggested that in a worst-case scenario, we might see restrictions placed on the amount of fuel that an individual could buy each day or prioritising emergency services. So even if carless days were a botched attempt to reduce petrol consumption, in principle, is this kind of strategy sound?
I come back with the question, how are you going to decide who gets what? So maybe I'm a single person commuting to work. Am I going to get a smaller allowance than a family who has to drop kids off at school? Both parents are working and so on. So these regulations are really blunt instruments, and they just introduce a level of complexity into the system that in the end it just doesn't work. And also I might add black markets could arise. So, for example, if I get allocated so many litres of fuel and you get allocated less, we might be able to do a deal and we might be able to arbitrage, right? And so I can make some money out of my allocation from you. And so these are all sorts of complications and nuances that policymakers need to think very, very seriously about before using blunt instruments such as quantitative restrictions.
Going back to the late 70s and early 80s, under Muldoon's so-called Big Think strategy, New Zealand borrowed heavily from overseas in order to fund massive industrial projects designed to reduce our dependence on imported oil. These included the construction of power plants which harnessed New Zealand's own natural resources, as well as the electrification of large sections of the country's railway network. What were the successes and failures of this approach, and what would a 21st century version of Big Think look like?
Well, from what I can tell, all of the Think Big projects, bar one, and I can't remember exactly which one it was, it might have been the ammonia urea plant, But they did not yield a positive economic dividend to New Zealand. So they, from an investment point of view, they were a failure. Billions of dollars were borrowed to support these investments, and I imagine it was taxpayers in the end, over many years after Think Big, that it just continued paying off the debt. Today's Think Big, gosh, I guess the thing that comes to mind is the LNG plant that they're proposing. And I have yet to see an analysis that demonstrates clearly a positive net economic dividend to the economy. Lots of analyses have been done on their prices that have been estimated and so on, but from the point of view of a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis, I've yet to be convinced that this is a good decision going forward.
So you've said that renewable sources of energy provide greater security and that we need policy initiatives that focus on transition to electricity-based transport, heating, solar, wind, and geothermal development. Could you just talk a bit about what you would recommend if you had the government's ear right now?
Well, first off, I would consider policies that were revenue neutral. So, for example, the previous government's policy around EVs and larger fossil fuel-based forms of transport, to me, that seemed pretty innovative, and you got a response in terms of the uptake of EVs. And so, you know, policies like that can be creative, but we have to be really careful with these policies in terms of the incentives that are created and the implications for government debt. So I would be really, really careful about policies that produce financial incentives. And we need to think very carefully about how people react and uplift according to those policies. Now, in terms of electrification, this crisis, now remember, you can't predict these crises. They're black swan events. They just happen, like COVID, it just happens, right? And so we can't predict for them, but we can try and build resilient systems of energy supply. And New Zealand has got a marvelous opportunity. This is a strategic gift in a way. It's an irony in a way, but it's a strategic gift to a government to think about how we can foster the development of our renewable resources. And so politicians have this thing about saying, oh, well, you know, the lakes are low and the wind's not blowing, the sun's not shining, and we're going to have blackouts. We don't know what the economic cost of energy non-supply is in this country. So let's kick that one into touch. But what we can do is to foster the development of wind, solar. Well, New Zealand's way behind European countries in terms of solar uplift. Solar and geothermal, massive potential there. There's biomass. So there's all these opportunities there that we can build a more resilient system that can supply electricity not only for heating and so on, but also for the electrification of transport. So if you couple that with some initiatives around trying to incentivize the uplift of EVs and so on, then we are better positioned in the future with a more resilient system to handle these shocks that come at us, and they will come at us in the future.
That was Emeritus Professor Basil Sharp from the University of Auckland.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Community groups across Aotearoa are organising a National Day of Action to protest against the move-on orders proposed by the government. The Day of Action will be on Sunday, 29th of March, criticising the targeting of people who are already struggling on the streets. To discuss the move-on orders and the Day of Action, Tuesday Wire host Alex spoke to Kickback founder Aaron Hendry.
A few weeks ago, the government introduced their move-on orders. Can you just quickly run us over why we should be concerned about these rules?
Yeah, look, basically the move-on orders are a decision the government's made which will open up a pathway straight from the streets into prison. it's really concerning because what it does is basically give the power to the police to move people on who are experiencing homelessness. And if they don't move on, to either fine them or arrest them. And what's really important for us to understand is that the people we're talking about are people who don't have a safe place to live. They are experiencing homelessness, many of them, because of decisions this government has made to close access to emergency accommodation, which has meant that many of our whānau have gone to working income, asked for support, been denied that support, and end up sleeping on the streets. It's because of decisions the government's made to delay or slow the building of public housing and cancel, you know, building projects, because of the decisions the government's made to, you know, increase sanctions specifically on those who are experiencing homelessness and the impact that that has on people's ability to actually retain or even gain housing. And so there's a lot of decisions that have been made by our government over the last couple of years that have increased homelessness within Aotearoa, and it meant that we have more of our people sleeping rough outside. And rather than actually truly addressing that issue, the government has decided to implement what are some really cruel and harmful piece of legislation, which will mean that people who have nowhere else to go but to sleep outside in our city centres are now being harassed, punished and criminalised for the crime of having nowhere safe to sleep.
And as you say, especially thinking about like the safety and the vulnerability of these people on the streets, how then is the government's underlining rationale of quote unquote safety kind of contradictory here?
Yeah, I think we have to ask ourselves when the government says we need to make, you know, the city safe, like who for is probably the question. Yeah, we all agree that we all want to live in a community where everyone can thrive and, you know, we can feel like we can truly participate and belong in our city centres. And that includes, you know, our fellow Kiwis, our fellow Aucklanders or, you know, whānau citizens, wherever we are in the country, that have nowhere safe to live and are living outside. We recognise that those of our whānau who are sleeping outside are at the most risk of harm. People experiencing homelessness are more likely to be victims of harm and to be in situations where they are being harmed. They're not. And so what's really disappointing to us is that our government, instead of recognising that and ensuring that we are providing support for people, has chosen to punish those who are most vulnerable within this situation.
And so with that said, looking at kind of a response to this, what sort of organisation and coalition building are we seeing opposing these changes?
Look, there's organisations across the country that are mobilising to respond to this. There's been huge outrage and anger as a response to the decision the government's made. You know, what's really interesting for us, a kickback is the conversations we have with people from across the political sphere, you know, business leaders, community leaders, you know, regular people that maybe vote on all sides of the political spectrum but recognise how cruel this is and how this really shouldn't go ahead. You know, kickback's a part of a broader coalition of organisations such as Kaia Whina, People Against Prisons Aotearoa, Action Station, Youth and Justice Coalition, AAAP, and many others who are calling for a National Day of Action on the 29th of March. And that's been received really well. And we have organisations across the Motu that are beginning to organise and are planning to respond to this move on orders, to respond and to call for the, you know, for us to come together and move on the move on orders.
And what would this National Day of Action actually entail?
Yeah, look, it's going to look different in every space. Basically, the call is that if you're passionate about this, if you think that something needs to change, if you're, you know, really concerned about the impact this is going to have on our community, then, you know, we encourage you to do something. You know, pull together, you know, your friends, your whānau, get together and get organised and do something that makes a noise and helps us to really highlight, you know, what's going on here. You know, for us in Tamaki, we've spoken a lot about grounding our action in our values, in the alternative future, the alternative communities that we want to build. You know, we recognise and we know that we can end homelessness in Aotearoa, and really the power for that lies in our communities. It's about us kind of looking inward and seeing how can we build the sort of communities where everyone is safe, included, cared for. And so these actions will look different, you know, based on this community to community. If you're interested in being involved in an action in your region, you feel free to kind of get a hold of us. You can go to our Instagram page or Kickback May Change, send us a message and we can get you connected to the right person. And yeah, there's actions being planned across the country at the moment. And if you want to get involved, if you want to start your own, you know, go for it.
And thinking about this National Day of Action, what really, when we're talking about like opposing these changes, what really is the goal in being hired by the government?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing that we are really hoping to highlight is one, that there is alternatives to this. It's really clear to us that homelessness is a political choice. It is a choice that our leaders make, not to invest in our communities. So instead of punishing people for the crime of having nowhere safe to sleep, the government could make the decision to invest in immediate housing services. So, you know, services that ensure immediate access to shelter for those who need it. The government could make the decision to invest in outreach centres and outreach services to ensure that we get connected to whānau who need support and get them the support they need to navigate the system. The government could ensure that we implement duty to assist legislation to make certain that no one ever walks into a State Department, work and income, asks for support and is left to sleep on our streets. And the government could decide to build more public housing. And so there's a whole range of decisions our government could make that would both begin to prevent homelessness and start the process of ending homelessness in Aotearoa. And yet what they're deciding to do is to punish people who are the victims of an economic system that many of them had no hand in really creating. And so I guess what we are saying really clearly is that there are alternatives to this. We as a community can decide to make different decisions, but we need our political leaders to listen and to lead and ensure that all of our whānau and all of our people are cared for and looked after. And we think it's absolutely unacceptable and actually, you know, abhorrent that instead of caring for those of our people who are suffering the most in our society, we are developing legislation to punish them.
And especially kind of just to almost wrap up, looking at especially paths forward for the government, what do you want to see from kind of the parties around government, maybe the opposition parties, in kind of pushing for like a real change for the benefit of, you know, New Zealanders in this space?
Yeah, look, we are hoping and asking of all political leaders who seek to govern this country to make some very strong and clear commitments to all of us around what they will do to both prevent and end homelessness within Aotearoa. And I've outlined, you know, the five or six or so, you know, steps that any future government could take if they were serious about addressing this issue. Specifically for opposition, if they are looking to come into government, the first thing they do is commit to rolling back the ban if it does go ahead, the bill, but also committing to those other things, you know, ensure that we have duty to assist legislation, ensure we're funding immediate housing services and outreach services, ensure that we have public housing and there's a strong commitment to building that, and that Kāinga Ora has a mandate to house our people, ensure that we don't have sanctions on people who are at risk of homelessness or experiencing homelessness. So there's some real clear decisions that our political leaders can make, and it is time for them to make them. You know, just saying, hey, look, it's really sad that people are sleeping on the street, it's just not acceptable any longer. We have to recognise and start to understand that we have power to change the situation. There does not need to be a world where any of our children, our young people, our whānau, our elders are sleeping outside because they don't have access to shelter. We can solve that. We can resolve that. But we need the commitment from all of our political leaders to act. Look, just that, you know, as we come up to this National Day of Action, just to remind people that, you know, one of the things we have at Kickback is we are the ones we've been waiting for. We do not have to wait for the government to act. We don't have to wait for our political leaders to act. It's about us, you know, on the 29th of March, coming together and starting to envision the community, you know, the sort of people that we want to be, grounding ourselves in our values of Aroha and Manaaki and starting to build the solutions that we hope for within our society. And so look, we encourage people to take courage. We can beat this bill. we will beat this bill, but it's going to take all of us coming together and having our voices heard and building solidarity with our whānau.
That was founder of Kickback, Aaron Hendry, speaking to Tuesday Wire host Alex about proposed move-on orders for rough sleepers and the National Day of Action proposed in protest.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
Yesterday, the government announced a $25 million funding boost for the health sector with 378 new roles. The government says the boost will support our health system to manage during the winter illness periods. Health unions, however, have said that while they're grateful for the funding, more is necessary to address the core issues within the health sector, with overcrowding and understaffing still significant issues. To discuss the scale of the problem and how much the new funding boost will help, I spoke to Chief Executive of the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, Paul Golter. We saw this government focusing on health early in its term, with discussions around cutting bureaucracy, hiring more staff, and reducing overcrowding. Has the government delivered on any of these promises?
No. And it's not just in the hospitals that they've not been able to deliver on that. It's also across primary health care with general practitioners, Plunkett hospices, Māori and iwi providers. Right, I think everyone agrees, and I know this because I've seen polls to this effect. New Zealanders just have completely lost faith in their health system. Not the people who work in it, but the fact that this is, the under-resourcing of our health system is really creating a crisis.
And a lot of people focus on the roles of doctors in our health system. However, nurses also serve an important role. How important are nurses to ensure that everything runs smoothly? And what do we see when there's low staffing numbers for nurses?
Okay, nurses are absolutely central to good health care, be it in a, you know, a doctor's surgery, right through to very complicated operations and so on. That's why there are way more nurses in our health system than any other profession, because they reach across so many different areas in providing care. So that they're absolutely vital to it, and what they are frustrated about is that wherever they work, they struggle to provide the level of care that their training and profession knows that needs to be provided to New Zealanders. And that just can't be done because they're understaffed and under-resourced. And that is something that nurses call a moral injury or moral distress, because they're caught up in the dilemma between knowing what they need to do and not being resourced to be able to do it.
And so what's the scale of the problem we're seeing right now? Are there, you know, what's the degree of nursing shortages that we're seeing across the country?
Well, it's we did some work with some data for period 22 to 24. We found there was an average of 580 nurses short per shift. That's in the hospitals. Across the, problem has got worse. In the other areas of the health sector, like aged residential care, there's always a struggle to get nurses into that area to ensure that our elderly receive the care and support they need. And that's always a problem. And one of the problems in aged residential care and also in primary health is what we call a pay parity gap, in that the pay that those people receive is significantly less than what you can earn in the hospitals. And so people tend to leave those parts of nursing and go and work in the hospitals. So it has this knock-on effect. So every nurse is being impacted by this refusal to fund the health system at the level that it needs.
And I've preempted the answer a little bit, but if you could talk about the government announcement yesterday. We saw $50 million announced, 378 new staff members. Is this enough? I mean, will this make an impact on what we're seeing right now?
Well, first of all, I have to recognise any addition of staff is a good move. The issue is it an adequate number? And this is where we run into problems. As I said, on our survey in hospitals, an average of 580 nurses per shift short across the hospital system. That's almost double the number of not just nurses, but doctors in allied health, wrapped up in the figure that the minister announced. And also, he said we're going to staff up for the impact of winter. Well, what our data shows that the needed number of nurses or availability of nurses triples between April and July. It requires, on our estimate, three times what would be needed in or is available in an already short staff situation. So the number that the minister announced won't go anywhere near to dealing with what New Zealanders are going to face.
Yeah, and so if this change is, or this boost is inadequate, what would you like to see from the government, especially as we're moving into an election year, you know, with different parties campaigning on this health policy platform? What kind of policies could we be looking at that would make it easier for nurses to provide the service that they're trying to provide?
Fundamental is the need for a workforce policy that's going to deliver the right number of trained nurses at the right time. And at the moment, this government appears completely incapable of doing that. And the number of nurses being driven by budget rather than need. And this is a really serious binary issue between nurses and the government, in that the government is only interested in budget numbers, and nurses are interested in what's the care that New Zealand citizens need and deserve. And actually, the sad story is that this government will continue to promote the primacy of budget over the primacy of needed care. It's very sad.
Yeah, and I guess continuing along that thought, I mean, the government has raised some concerns around the financial costs of the health sector and financial costs of having these staff. Is there also another cost in not having an adequate amount of staff in our hospitals?
I think that's a very good question. Of course, there is a dramatic cost. And a good example is emergency departments. If someone goes into an emergency department with an injury or illness or sickness, and they're waiting there for 5-6 hours, they often just get up and leave. And that means the problem's not fixed. So they represent later on with the problem not fixed, but in fact it's got worse. And so the care they're going to need has actually increased, and the cost of it will have increased because the system wasn't funded to provide the right number of staff to address that patient's need right at the start. So you get this magnifying effect going on, and this is why primary health is really important. That's with GPs and urgent clinics and that level, because if we can get the care to patients at the very first time they present to the health system, we can actually ensure that that they're being cared for and the costs are being controlled.
That was Chief Executive of the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, Paul Galter, speaking to me about a government health funding boost and whether it will deal with the problems in the health sector.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki mātou mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Associate Professor at the New Zealand Law School, Vernon Rive, Dr. Basil Sharp, Kickback Founder Aaron Hendry, and New Zealand Nurses Organisation Chief Executive Paul Galter. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.